this first lady. The military regime has never officially acknowledged that the young Kim was married, but in recent weeks, Kim was seen in public with a woman who appeared prominently with him. Both were seen together during a recent concert showing Disney characters and later visiting a kindergarten together. For NPR News, I'm Duahli Saikautau in Seoul.
Same-sex marriage may soon be legalized in Scotland. Lawmakers say legislation has backing from the major Scottish political parties. When enacted, Scotland could become the first country in the UK to allow same-sex marriages. The UK government has conducted a public consultation on legalizing marriages, and it has the support of Prime Minister David Cameron. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Ally Bank, who values straightforward reporting and straightforward banking. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. How do we explain the willingness of one person to sacrifice for another? Now, it is certainly true that people will put the interests of their family ahead of their own. But our guest for this hour of Focus, biologist Edward O. Wilson, argues that more important in human development has been the advancement of the group, even those members who do not share our genes. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking about the book that Professor Wilson has written. It's a book that explores the biological roots of human culture, and the title of the book is The Social Conquest of Earth. It is published by Liverlight, which is a division of W.W. Norton. Liverlight Books, a division of W.W. Norton. It's out recently, has been getting a lot of attention, has caused some controversy within the field of biology, because not all of his fellow biologists agree with the argument that he makes, and we'll talk about it in this hour of the show. E.O. Wilson is thought of as being one of the world's leading biologists and naturalists. He is the author of more than 20 books. He is emeritus professor at Harvard University. He's joining us this morning by phone. And Professor Wilson, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
I want to try to get at what seems to be the basic idea here, and I don't want to oversimplify, but it strikes me the argument runs something like this. I would have said previously that the most important thing for living things is to see that their genetic material gets passed on, that it survives. So that's why it's important to people that their children survive and maybe their siblings survive, and they'll do what they have to, including sacrificing their own interests to see that happen. Your argument is that, in fact, the more important thing here, it's not so much me and my genes as it is the fate of the group of individuals to which I belong, to which I identify, and that what you're arguing is, in fact, that people will put the interests of the group ahead of their own, even if we're talking about individuals that are not their children, siblings, with whom they share no genetic material. Do I essentially have it?
Let me rephrase it somewhat.
Yes.
By saying that all species with very advanced social behavior based on altruism, and their are about 24 of which we know living such evolutionary lines. That's all we know from the whole history of life. It's a rare condition. Have been shaped by three forces of selection in evolution. That is, natural selection, evolution, created by natural selection.
Mm-hmm.
And those three are, first, individual level selection, and that's classical Darwinian selection. That's parents to offspring. The intense desire expressed by individuals to have and defend their offspring to put as many offspring in the next generation as possible. That's individual level selection. There's never been any doubt about the power of this, because it determines a great, virtually all of the critical physiology and behavior of all species of organisms. But then there is another one, which appears in advanced stages of social evolution, and that's group selection. That comes about through competition between groups, one group against the other. And the genes that favor the ability of one group to prevail over another, whether it's in using resources better or in direct conflict, has individuals with genes that favor that competitive ability. And then the third is kin selection. So what has happened, and that's where you defend and promote collateral kin, that is siblings, uncle, aunt, so on, and so out through a web of kin. Hmm. For the last 40 years, most of it, and I was partly responsible for this when I introduced the whole subject in a couple of books in the 1970s. That is, I explained it and applied it in these books. In the view that was prevailing until fairly recently, it was collateral kin preference in addition to individual, that is, parent to offspring. But collateral kin selection was thought of as taking care of kin in all directions as the key to understanding advanced social behavior with altruism. But now, and the same view, sideline group selection, agreed that it could occur, but it was of little importance. Now, overwhelming evidence, in my judgment, plus a mathematical demonstration that the foundations of the kin selection theory as a forcer of advanced social behavior has been discredited or eliminated practically. And we're back to group selection, group versus group, and individual selection as the shapers of behavior, and group selection as the main source of altruism outside of the individual and his immediate relatives, particularly descendants. Hmm. That's where we are right now. And that shift and those of us who are involved in making the studies are convinced is the correct shift, has very substantial implications different from the ones that were held before concerning the human condition and why we act the way we do. Mm-hmm.
And so that I'm glad now you made it a little bit more subtle than the way I framed it initially. And I think an important, again, to underline that what we're talking about here is the behavior of social species. So we're talking
about social behavior appears. That's right. It's elaborated by what kind of force selection. We now believe not kin selection, just looking after your kin network, but no, much stronger and more pervasive than that. It's group versus group. And here's another way of putting it, if I might just go on to make it, I think, a little clearer. Mm-hmm. It's something of an oversimplification, but I think it makes it clear, easier to see, that within groups, among groups, competing within a group, individual level selection going on, we find that it's overall selfish individuals defeat altruist. But between groups, we find that groups of altruistic individuals defeat groups of selfish individuals. So you see the two are in opposition to one another. And making it even simpler, if I may, you say individual selection is responsible for what we usually call sin, and group selection is responsible for what we usually refer to as virtue.
Hmm. And certainly, though, that would you say that within any individual there are these two impulses, and they are in tension with one another.
Precisely, and that's a tremendously important point, because it means that we were shaped by two opposing forces, and also the fact that group selection does run against, in most situations, individual selection. It's a rarity. In fact, that it prevails enough to push species on up to advanced social organization based on altruistic behavior. As I said, and this was the aspect of it, one of the aspects overlooked by those who remained loyal to kin selection as the primary force. They overlooked the fact that there have only been about two dozen known cases of advanced social behavior of that kind with altruism. And there has to be a reason for that rarity. And that is almost certainly that group selection can only get established under special circumstances that favor it. And when we track all of those two dozen cases, which I've now done, which usually hasn't been done or even mentioned in the discussions in the past, it turns out that every one of those known cases evolved to this point of advanced social favor based on altruism through a particular set of steps accidentally taken that brought them to the threshold of this advanced social behavior. And that final step, which occurred apparently without any known exception, was the building of a defensible nest in which a single individual, a female, a mother, or mated pair, or a very loose group, defended, sent out foragers to come back with food to feed young in the nest to maturity. All of them had to take that, get to that point before they went over into what we have now in the human condition, and then a couple dozen animal societies of which we have some knowledge.
The reason that, as I mentioned, that this is controversial is within the field of evolutionary biology, there are still individuals that are holding to the kin selection, the primacy of kin selection, and they believe that you are mistaken and you're wanting to elevate group selection. There would have been a time when you would have been in with the kin selection contingent. What was it that led you to change your own thinking and to want to say, in fact, you believe that it is this group selection that really is the most important thing?
About 10 years ago, I saw that kin selection body of theory was not working very well. It really was being applied consistently only to a couple of phenomena, and not too convincingly to those, and that the math didn't seem quite that forceful. I saw that the cases that were being promoted could be explained without kin selection, you know, known biological cases. And so it was 5 or 6 years ago that I started to publish a series of papers pointing out the flaws and suggesting that maybe we had better start looking at group selection again. There were a number of others doing this. Others were beginning to, harbor doubts. These included several of the leading experts on social insects who were intimately familiar with the evidence also. Then, 2 years ago, I didn't get much response from this. Things just went on as they were before. But 2 years ago, two mathematicians at Harvard, Martin Novak and a young Romanian named Corina Tarnita, who I think I can say fairly are mathematicians of the first rank, meaning that you needed that, as it turned out, to examine the whole situation down to the foundations analytically, came to me and said that they'd begin to look at this whole thing themselves, and that they found that the foundations of kin selection theory, that is the theory that kin selection does is the key to advanced social behavior, were unsound. It didn't work. So we got together. They did the difficult analytic work to really take it out all the way, work that was vetted by leading mathematicians, by Nature magazine, and others who followed the argument. We combined that with the case-by-case analysis I did of the biological examples of supposed kin selection, showing that you get just as good a result or a better from group selection. And we put those together in a paper in November 2010 in a Nature article. I'm going into this detail to show you why this was done. Mm-hmm. That was 18 months ago. It did cause a tremendous blowback by a group, not a very that large a group. They got a lot of signatories to add to a protest letter to Nature about our article. But to this day, 18 months later, no one has actually challenged the science in our article. No one has challenged the mathematical analysis, and none, to my knowledge, has challenged the biological analysis. The most of the controversy consists in saying we didn't give enough credit to kin selection. But you can't give credit to a body of theory, the mathematical foundations of which are invalid, and to which there are alternative explanations based upon a more mathematically valid foundation. Mm. So that's what's happening, and now it's time to move ahead and take a look at what the consequences would be of what we call multi-level selection. Group selection, just as you said, the primary driving force that puts species up to the highest level and in contest with individual-level selection. The results are extremely interesting, and they really do fit most of what we know about human social behavior far better than something anything derived from the old kin selection theory.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Edward O. Wilson. He is an emeritus professor at Harvard University, and he's the author of many books. His most recent that lays out this argument that we're talking about here this morning is titled The Social Conquest of Earth. It's published by Liveright, which is a division of W.W. Norton. The book is out now if you want to take a look at it. It's getting a lot of attention. Questions are welcome. We have one individual here, someone who is ready to go. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And also email, if you'd like to send in your comments that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. And our first caller here is here where we are, Champaign County. This will be line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I'm actually really punting on this, but I wonder whether you can relate. I don't actually know what you're referring to in the mechanism of social selection. So maybe in the light of what I'm going to ask, you can elucidate that. But is this in any way in your mind or could be related to this, what I think is a misapprehension of Darwinism, that particularly social Darwinism always emphasizes the survival of the fittest as opposed to the survival of the fit, and looking at the niche that any group or particular organism lives in, and that the social choices that you're thinking about may, I'm wondering whether you might say they would relate to, the choices that preserve the niche, whether it be the planet Earth or some particular set of relations in an ecosystem. I guess I'm going to hang up and listen off the air. I hope that was clear enough.
Yeah, that was a great array of questions you just asked, and we need to deal with social Darwinism by saying right away. It was a misapprehension of Darwin's original theory. And also, it became a political ideology. This misapprehension became a political ideology. It had to do with what is good is the triumph of the best group or the best ensemble of genetically distinct individuals and so on. It's been thoroughly discredited since the 1920s, as a matter of fact, although unfortunately picked up again by some extreme right groups. At any rate, let's lay it aside. Darwin himself understood the foundations of what I was saying, that is, intuitively. And in The Origin of Species, he came up, as he said in his memoirs, the most powerful potential objection to his theory of evolution by natural selection in, actually, the ants. He took a long while thinking about it, as he said, and finally solved it by a kind of group selection. The colony-level selection could produce highly altruistic ants, and he had that right. We sort of let that go as kin selection came back and started coming into the picture three or four decades ago. But then in The Descent of Man, you find him arguing for group selection as a key to the origin of human advanced social behavior in humans, although he has only one paragraph there. Darwin really was not promoting anything like what we call social Darwinism. Indeed, he was already talking about the origins of altruism in the way right now, I hope in a much more solid and sophisticated manner, we're talking about it today.
I want to talk some more about this move from, say, ant society to human society. And if what we're trying to do is explain how it is that, say, I as an individual would be willing to go out and get food and bring it back and feed it to someone else's children, or that I would be willing to go out and defend our colony against enemies and defend, go out and put my life on the line for people that are not my genetic relatives. You say, well, what it happens because it has individuals have the willingness to do that advantages those individuals. And if that happens enough, that's natural selection. And so we're going to get to whole groups of individuals who have that drive. If in the case of an ant, though, that's something that's programmed into them, then do we have to find another way to explain why humans would do that?
Well, it's programmed into us, too. You remember I just said that in every known case of the 24 or so in which this has occurred in animals, it's gone through this stage of feeding young and raising it to maturity. Now, that's very common, not very common, but it's not uncommon. There are quite a few species of wasp and other insects and other invertebrate animals that do this. But only a tiny number of them, a percentage, has then gone over to altruistic groups forming. This means that group selection has to be very powerful to overcome individual-level selection. And that is understandable because consider your wasp species, for example, that has reached the stage, and there's a mutation, a simple one, the kind that you find all the time, that silences the tendency for the young to disperse from the nest. Well, they now will automatically form an altruistic-based group. Why is it automatic? It's because experiments have shown that if you take solitary insects that normally don't form societies and you force them to occupy the same nest, then they automatically fall into dominance rankings, one becomes the queen and the other becomes the worker. And why is this? Well, it's almost certainly a case of extended territorial behavior. All these creatures have territories around their nest, so that if one takes possession of the nest and another one is forced to be there too, the other then takes the position of the subordinate with reference to a territorial instinct that the two have. So there's no difficulty in explaining what happens. It's also, we need a lot more research to find out why group selection is rarely, or circumstances in which it can overcome individual level selection, at least to coexist with it. Hmm. Now we come to humans. Well, surely humans did something differently. Did they not? If they have culture and they have all this plasticity in their behavior? Well, actually not. If you track, as you now can do, particularly with the superb work being done by anthropologists and geneticists during the last 20 years, track what really happened in Africa that led up to Homo, the last sprint to the human condition between 3 and 2 million years ago, is when we see the human line begin the very steep ascent in the size of the brain from a chimp level. 3 million years ago, or a little bit more, our direct ancestors had brains only about the size of a chin or a little larger. Suddenly, it began to increase dramatically. What happened? These were among the Homo habilis type antecedents. And what happened was that they switched to meat. They added meat substantially. And throughout the animal kingdom, when creatures become carnivores and they have any kind of social behavior to start with, you know, like in chimps, then they begin to form nests, the dens, campsites. And when they do, certainly in the case of the human ancestors, they would be brought into close contact with one another, paying close attention to one another's behavior, which chimps don't do, and reading intention, as the cognitive and social psychologists now are emphasizing has happened. And they need a high level of social intelligence to survive as a group and as individuals within the group. So we see then this ascent from about 400 cubic centimeters to 1,000 or 1,200 in a very short period of time. And it looks as though human beings did just the same thing that the 24 or so or 2 dozen or so animal species had done that made them unique, otherwise unique in the evolution of life. Mm.
We are at our midpoint here. We need to take a very short break. After that, we'll talk some more with our guest, E.O. Wilson, author of The Social Conquest of Earth. This is Focus.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Bishop Leonard Blair. He helped conduct the doctrinal assessment of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, an organization representing 80% of U.S. nuns. Now he's assigned to help make sure the group conforms to the church's teachings on human sexuality, the right to life, the ordination of women, and other issues. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Edward O. Wilson, one of the world's leading biologists and naturalists, author of many books. His most recent is The Social Conquest of Earth, and it is published by Liveright. That's a division of W.W. Norton. The book is out recently, has been getting a lot of attention. We're pleased to have him as our guest. We have another caller here, someone who is in Olney, and that's our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
I have kind of an elementary question, I guess, about maybe definition of terms, because it seems to me like most individuals and groups would be related to one another, so I'm not sure how that is different from kin selection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point, and they are closely related to one another in the earliest stages of this advanced condition. But as I've pointed out, that close relatedness is a consequence of the way group selection starts and pushes altruism up to such a high level. It's not the cause. If you think about it for a minute, if, in fact, it is a tightly knit group that is defending a nest site, and this means has to cooperate if it's going to continue defending and utilizing the nest site, campsite, then it is going to have to engage in a lot of close interaction. That means social intelligence. And that's what starts the process, passing through that final threshold, which, as I said, we know of no exception to that having occurred. Then the individuals that first pass through it will be closely related to one another. And that's a consequence, not the cause of it, but a consequence. There are lots and lots of other situations in which very closely related individuals form groups, but they don't go through this higher level in which the organization is based on altruism of other than parents and immediate offspring. And so it appears that this is what's going on. They're more closely related at the beginning, and that will allow the evolution to the eusocial or higher social state to be speeded up, because then that type of group, whether the gene is there to promote it, is already aggregated, but it doesn't lead to it. It speeds up getting there, but it doesn't lead to it.
Does that get at your question, caller? You want to follow up?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, it's getting closer, but I'll just have to keep listening and see how I can follow the full argument.
All right. Well, others are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like Professor Wilson to ask you about another set of questions here. It's certainly the case, it seems, that there's this complex social behavior that's displayed by bees and ants and humans. There are some things that humans do, like politics and religion and philosophy and art, that bees and ants don't do. Why do humans do them?
Well, of course, I didn't mean to imply that we were anything but a far higher level. What I was doing was addressing the question of why we are this way. How mm-hmm. did it happen? Mm-hmm. And what does that the better understanding of that origin imply for our understanding of these later stages of the ascent of culture, and then the progression from hunter-gatherer bands to chiefdoms to state, all the things that anthropologists and sociologists are interested in, and people in the humanities, including the creative arts. Then when you get to the basic genetic theory, you realize that you're dealing with what the unit of selection, which is a gene, mm-hmm. with the target of the selection, of which is the product created by the gene. One gene actually can produce traits. One former gene can produce traits that have advantage in individual selection, and at the same time in group selection. What counts is the trait itself and how selection works on it. And the action of the gene to create a trait can be very rigid and flexible, like, you know, five fingers on one hand, or it can be flexible in what it produces, like a water lily, that when the lily grows above the water surface, it is like a traditional lily, and when it grows below, it's like eelgrass. But that's still one gene and an ensemble of traits which are flexible, but they are set. in how extensive they are. In human beings, we certainly have enormous flexibility in some traits. But when you think about it, in many of our traits, we don't have much flexibility. The way we learn languages, the way we have phobias develop or not develop, all of the phenomena of bonding, the intense desire that people have that we haven't even thought of as an instinct, but it is, overwhelming, intense desire to form groups and to have groups compete with other groups. We do that instinctively. And also the intense interest we have in each other. Most of the humanities are based on that intense history and all the possible stories can be told about it. And that has enormous value, the social intelligence that's being expressed in the success of group versus group.
So that your argument is that all, and again, I hope I'm not oversimplifying too much, but that human culture is an artifact, something that grows out of the fact that for individuals to live successfully this way in groups, it's vital for people to have an understanding of others.
Within the group,
to have understanding of other people, understanding what's going on with them, what they're experiencing, perhaps also how to get out of that person what you want. That you have to have that for these kind of groups to succeed. But once you have that in a place, then a lot of other things can grow from that.
And so they have. Take religion and the conflict between religions, which is a very important part of contemporary life. The competition between groups that created religions, or at least organized religions, our focus shouldn't be on the transcendent parts of it. That is, the theological examination, consideration of astral unities and eternity, and of course the hopes for afterlife and the like. Groups don't argue about things like that. What organized religions argue about, and in a deadly fashion, is their creation stories. Every group has a different creation story, every organized religion, and there are hundreds of them. And it's set in stone, and it's based usually on early stories put together by shamans and prophets, and each one differing from the other is nonetheless considered sacred. And this is why people bristle at any questioning of their creation story, from which dogmas are derived. And why they bristle is not theological disagreements. They bristle because you're challenging something that is absolutely vital to their sense of identity and sense of well-being. You're challenging their tribe. And this is something that we're having a terrible problem, even moderating, damping. Mm-hmm. But if we understand where it all came from, then maybe we would be able to damp it a bit and get mutual understanding between groups to turn into authentic peace movements. Hmm.
But this, I guess what makes this interesting, challenging, and perhaps also difficult is that it suggests that the best in us, art, philosophy, religion perhaps, and also the worst, racism, genocide, all has the same explanation.
Yeah, that's the human dilemma, that we are strung between the two opposing forces of natural selection. Individual level selection on the one side, group selection on the other side. If we were to, and therefore we cannot find an ideal solution. There is no ideal ideology, probably, or ideal political system. If we went all the way toward the products of individual level selection, the society would dissolve. If we went all the way to the products of group selection, we would be angelic robots. We'd be like ants. So we're in the middle. We're all conflicted. Human beings are innately conflicted. And when you see it that way, then you understand why we're conflicted and why we have all these tremendous difficulties finding peace between groups. And that's just the way things are. I mean, it isn't that we are being tested by God or lured away from the perfect existence and harmony that we're predestined to find by Satan. We are just made that way. You cannot produce something like a human species, it would seem, without producing a conflicted condition.
Well, let us talk with another caller. We have someone who'd like to get into the conversation here. Line one in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask Dr. Wilson to give his views on connecting two interests of his. I know he's also very concerned about or interested in a rising human population, which is projected to be about 9.2 billion by, I think, about 2050. And this is going to be accompanied by raising expectations and wherewithal in the developing world. And I'd like to get your insight or your views concerning the coupling of your theory or your hypothesis of the group behavior, human group, altruistic group behavior, and looking forward and trying to see ways in which humanity could perhaps work as an expanded identity of what constitutes a group to address this problem. So I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you for taking the call.
All right.
Yeah, it's a tough question, actually. It's just why we go on destroying the rest of life. I think it's probably that we never evolved to look after life. We evolved as, Homo sapiens, modern Homo sapiens, broke out of Africa about 60,000 years ago and spread at warp speed, almost as much as a population growth could allow, around most of the rest of the world, and then started using the environment up as best it could. When we entered the Neolithic period some 10 to 12,000 years ago, we were able to create very dense population, and then we really started changing, removing the rest of life and its natural environments to produce more people. It just seemed the right thing to be able to do. Now we're stuck with that propensity to just make more people at the expense of the rest of life. But we can wake up, I think, into just why we do this and why we're such lousy conservationists, even with all the information we have. And we do have one thing going for us. Well, we have a number of things going for us. We're becoming much more aware of the destruction that we're causing so recklessly. And we can be aware of why we're that way. I don't think we have a completely clear explanation, but what I just said seems to be pointing in the right direction. But then we have this extraordinary stroke of luck, which is that women, once women get, this is not a left-wing ideology, this is just factual. When women get some degree of independence over their own lives, economic independence especially, the birth rate plummets. You are probably aware that virtually every industrialized country in the world which has women, some degree of women's choice and freedom, the fertility, the number of children per woman is plummeting. It's below everywhere in those countries, below 2.1, the break-even point. So the United Nations projection, which you just cited, has us about, if we're at, follow current trends, we may, we'll peak and maybe start coming down somewhere around 9 billion. If it intensifies, we could peak below that. If it doesn't, if we have a reversal to what we were, it could go to 18 or 20 billion by the end of the century or a little afterward. So let's hope that trend continues and that we'll actually bring it under control just by a stroke of luck. I mean, we didn't do it by human genius. We just did it by, I think, a common sense of decency.
We're coming to the point where we have about 3-4 minutes left in this hour with Edward Wilson, Edward O. Wilson from Harvard. He's an emeritus professor there and is well-known for writing about biology and the natural world. His new book is The Social Conquest of Earth. I'm continuing to think about how some people might find it troubling if what they take away from here is the idea that, say, something like genocide is ingrained in us at the genetic level. But does knowing that actually help if one's intention is that groups of individuals should live peacefully with one another?
Yeah. We've easily slide into genocide, don't we? I mean, it's something that's happened repeatedly. But just because we have this weakness bequeathed us by the conflict between group and individual level selection doesn't mean that that's a good thing for the future of the world. Mm. The parallel is that when we discover the source of, say, some illness, a pathogen that can be quelled, a vitamin deficiency that can be fixed that helps us reduce or eliminate a disease, we do it. And we don't say that discovering the pathogen or the vitamin deficiency can somehow validate continuing to have the disease. I think the parallel there is pretty clear. Understanding why we have acted in such a horrific fashion, we, all of us practically, in wars and genocide, just because we're closer to understand why we did it, certainly does not mean that we should be continuing it.
Is it reasonable to think that the human species might survive long enough so that a change at the genetic level to thinking about survival of the entire species as being important could actually come about?
Conceivable, but I'd rather do it by reason and knowledge. I think we're capable of it. I don't think, that's way off into the future. It's science fiction of gene substitution to produce more Pacific in humans. In fact, I don't think we want that because of the, when you're looking at the future, because the conflicted nature and this constant struggle we have within ourselves and among ourselves has created enormous damage in what you call inhumanity. But at the same time, it's the nuclear generator of our creativity. I wouldn't want us, or like to think of the future as kind of a homogeneous, passive species, just dwelling on the earth and not doing much except dwell there.
Yeah, I suppose then we would be ants.
Getting close.
We'll try real quick to get one caller in here in Urbana. Line one, go ahead.
Hi. Maybe you've talked about this. It's a little late to bring it up, but do you consider at all the transition from single-cell life to multicellular life, which is an early form of social organization?
Yes. You're precisely correct. What you've just said is actually refers to what is emerging, I think, as the basic theory of the origin of different levels of biological groupings and organization, cell to tissue to organ the organism, on and up. And each one, if you look back, just as in the origin of advanced social behavior based on altruism, each one was quite rare and took an enormously long period of time. What you just said is probably indicates the clue we have to developing an authentic theory of biology.
We are going to have to stop. My apologies. We're simply at the end of our time. If you'd like to read more on the subject, look for the book, The Social Conquest of Earth, published by Liveright, which is a division of W.W. Norton, by our guest, Edward O. Wilson. He is emeritus professor at Harvard, author of many books. This is his most recent. Professor Wilson, thank you very much for talking
to us. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
On tomorrow's Focus, in the first hour of the program, a conversation, actually a rebroadcast of a conversation from May of this year with Homer Hickam, writer and former aerospace engineer with NASA. You may recall his memoir, October Boys. It was the basis for a film, a film called October Sky. If you remember Jake Gyllenhaal in that movie, well, he played Homer Hickam in the movie. So great conversation from May that David Inch had with Homer Hickam. That's in the first hour of the program tomorrow. Then in the second hour, conversation with Denise Cummins, a professor of psychology and philosophy at the University of Illinois, about her book, Good Thinking, Seven Powerful Ideas That Influence the Way We Think. Those are the topics, conversations on Focus tomorrow from 10 till noon. Tune in. It's 11:58, and coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine here on AM 580. Among the stories we're following at this hour, Governor Quinn has signed a couple of consumer protection laws. Champaign City Council members have endorsed a deal to provide tax incentives to the owners of the Carriage Center car dealerships for a new site within the city. And the Vermilion County Board has allowed video gambling to proceed in unincorporated parts of that county. We'll have details on those stories and much more over the course of the next hour as we'll give you news from NPR, the BBC, and Illinois Public Media. Let's catch you up on what's happening in the commodity markets. The latest tick starting with Kansas City wheat for September, trading at 906 and three quarters, up 26 and a quarter. December wheat at 925, up 27. Chicago wheat for September is at 902 and three quarters, up 24. December wheat at 914, up 25 and three quarters. September corn is trading at 797, up 7. December corn at 791. Make that, yes, 791. And that's up 12 and three quarters. August beans at 1689 and a quarter, up 40. September soybeans at 1637 and three quarters, up 42 and a quarter. August soybean meal trading at 528.20, that's up 1840. September soybean meal at 507.40, up 1510. August soybean oil at 52.17, that's up 59 cents. September soybean oil at 52.36, also up 59. August live cattle trading at 118.02 and a half, down 77 and a half. October live cattle at 122.80, down 52 and a half cents. August feeder cattle at 135.65, that's down $2. Let me give you the latest tick. Now, August feeder cattle at 135.70, down $1.97 and a half cents. September feeder cattle at 138.30, that's down 205. Augustine hogs at 94.62.5, up 170, and October lean hogs at 80.30, up 227.5 in trading on the day. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9